And we're back.
Welcome to No Direction Beyond, the Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. Hi, folks. I'm your host, Owen Casey Stevens, and with me today are
Alexander Gunas, the Everyman Gamer.
It's my code switch, currently on hiatus.
And I'm Vanessa Hoskins. I am monitoring the stream.
Thanks, Vanessa. And with us today is our special guest, Joe Piscini, who's the Starfinder lead designer for Paizo. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're really excited to have the Starfinder lead designer on the show, and we wanted to talk to you as someone that we haven't had on the show yet, which I think is a huge oversight on our part, and one hopefully we will fix by having you on lots in the future. And also talk to you about Near Space, the very exciting new Starfinder hardback book that has hit some of our shelves recently. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, all things considered. How about yourself?
I think also on a scale from one to pandemic, I'm doing fine.
Fair.
So it was pointed out to me that one of the things that is normally asked of people when we have them on the show, especially for the first time, is how did you get involved in role-playing, Joe, and specifically from role-playing to role-playing design?
Wow, what a long, strange trip it's been. I had some abortive attempts as a youth. My friends were too cool to play D&D with me. That's fine. I got to read the books anyway and make up stories, make characters. You don't need friends for that. But then fast forward into my late 20s, I got to play a little more D&D, started GMing a 13th Age campaign. And I was just talking to someone today about their amazing GMing skills, and it reminded me of how much effort I used to put into game mastery before it all became on a napkin 2 hours before the session.
You're calling me out here, Piscini.
Yeah. But in terms of actually, yeah, in terms of entering the industry, that was sort of a backward, meandering, accidental route that I like to start at working at Nintendo as a game tester and then as a text editor for fun Vigi games. And then I ended up contract editing for Paizo and then full-time editing and then realizing that I really liked messing with the numbers and asking a lot of annoying questions, how mechanics work, which led to answers, which led to me having those answers. And then somehow ended up as a developer and then Starfinder's lead designer. Oh. And that's where I sit today, lording over tables.
Do you think like any of your previous job experience helps you with doing designing, like in stuff like QA and copy editing where you're looking for mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, being detail oriented is the name of the game. And also a lot of those rely on things like style guides and sort of existing canon that you lean on when you need to. But of course you use your brain and make choices that make sense. And it's a lot more collaborative than I would have thought originally going in. You know, I tend to think of editors, developers, designers as being like these people on a cliff, just making these decisions from on high, but it's really just, oh God, can you help me figure this out? I have no idea what this ability should do. What do you think? And talking to really talented and smart people like the host of the show here who taught me a lot of what I know.
Well, I mean, one, I know, cause you were doing editing on Starfinder when we were doing the original core rulebook, that one of the things that happened that opened up a path for development is you kept coming and asking questions like, hey, I'm editing this and it looks like what you've said here will do this incredibly horrible thing, or am I wrong? And I'd look at it and go, oh no, you're right. You're 100% right. This is bad wording, or these are bad numbers. On the other hand, sometimes I was so harried and crushed, I'm like, no, the pricing for medicinals is fine, Joe Piscini. Don't worry about that at all. I sat down and did those numbers. I'm sure there couldn't possibly be anything wrong.
Wait, Owen, does that mean you're in charge of Big Farm?
I am the secret voice behind big pharmaceuticals that are massively overcharging people for medicinals. Yes, that is 100% my fault. And Joe is currently the lead designer because he saw it early and none of us would listen to it.
That's funny.
That's an interesting take on that tale.
So Joe, I have a weird question for you. Are you ready? Ooh.
Okay. I love this. Yeah.
So if the Starfinder design team was a starship, what officer role does the lead designer occupy?
Gosh, that's a great question. I'd say chief mate. You're running around hitting things, hoping they work.
Oh my gosh.
And, and you kind of came onto the scene a little later than what people might have liked, but you're doing
your part. Late game arrival, but necessary.
Is it safe to say that Amanda's the person sitting in the captain's chair yelling and encouraging at everybody?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
I saw a nod from Owen there. Now I'm curious.
I think it's very important that we acknowledge that Rob and Amanda are probably hopping back and forth between the captain's seat and the pilot seat.
That's what I was thinking. I was going to say
one of them is helping everyone get everything done, and the other one's trying to figure out where the whole ship is going. And I feel they both do both jobs, although that is my take from nearly a year ago before I left Paizo. So
I think that's definitely pretty fair.
Okay. So I just realized that I didn't warn you that we were going to ask you about this. In the past few weeks, you have started to put out errata.
Oh, yeah.
And there has not been a regular release of errata for Starfinder. How have you found that process now that you're in charge of it?
Gosh. Well, it was a challenge, which we knew from the jump. I mean, that's something that I had talked to you, kind of been throwing in sideways every now and then, like, hey, if we do errata, if we find time, as we all laugh and cry blood at the same time, I'd love to be involved. And it's like, great, but here's eight other things you need to do first. And also, so getting a little bit of time to work on it and working on it over a long period of time, and also getting our tech team to help us sort of revamp the section of the site that holds the errata was huge and has made it a lot easier. We have a sort of back end for tracking things. I can hop into the forums and see what people are asking about and kind of evaluate, you know, the impact on play and whether this is something where somebody found a really interesting corner case that's not going to affect anyone ever. And maybe I don't need to spend like 2 hours, you know, going through the process of making that an official ruling on our part, versus the things that are like, oh yeah, that makes no sense. And we really need to clear that up for people. But it's been really rewarding. And I think largely in part because people have been so cool about it. I think a lot of people, I've seen multiple people say, hey, this isn't the ruling that I would have gone with, but I'm glad that we have an answer. And I think that's super mature, and I really appreciate it.
Well, and for a lot of these, when I saw the very first errata you put out, I'll admit that my first thought was, ooh, I want to check this and see if that's the ruling I would have made back when I was in charge of errata. And then I realized that there was no satisfaction. If that was my attitude going in, I would never be satisfied. So I really just wanted to go and look, if I'm running a Starfinder game or writing Starfinder material, how does this rule work? Because that's really all I need to know. Mm-hmm.
It's funny, I hadn't considered that you might be looking at these, and now I'm terrified of every choice I've made.
Oh, Joe, okay. It'll be fine. Owen's not a very noisily judgmental person. He's quietly judgmental.
Yeah, no, the real thing is you got to watch out if he offers you to buy you a drink, because at that point, that's where it's going to, like, it's like, oh, you're in for the long haul now.
Listen, I worked 4 feet away from Owen for years, so I know the slow turn of doing that. Like, don't mess with me right now.
Well, so there's the slow turn of that is not high on my priority of things I need to do for the paycheck to keep coming, which is very different from the, ooh, sitting as a backseat driver or a Monday morning quarterback, I can see making arguments about why this would get handled differently, but given the long lag between any of the erratas I was putting out when that was my job and how quickly you've started to put them out, I don't think I want to start poking holes at how errata is getting done. I don't believe that I'm going to be on the upper end of that analysis if it comes to it. I mean, James made a little heart when we were talking about you're putting out errata. So it's appreciated, and the game needs it. It's an important part of having a lead designer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything that makes...
Sorry, go ahead.
Nope.
No, you go ahead. You're the guest.
Talk. Fine, I'll go ahead. I was going to point out also that it isn't just me, of course, and I am bringing these things to the team. And, you know, there are people on the team sometimes who are like, yeah, I don't really agree with that. And I listen to those opinions and value them. And sometimes the ruling gets made anyway. But again, we're looking for a final answer for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And you're not always going to get unanimity. Why did I try to say that word on a stream? That's ridiculous.
Well, especially with something like society, any FAQ to rectify these issues really does go a long way, even if it's not the preferred, because then you have people acting more along the same system. Because lodges will slightly do things differently depending on who's there and what their participation is. So by having more rigid answers, it helps make it so when you all go to a convention, you're all playing the same game.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, you might be disappointed that your super niche case build doesn't work anymore, but at least now you know I shouldn't build my character on the assumption that the rules work this one way. We can all agree, okay, however much we might like them to, they don't, and do something else.
Right, but my character still works that way, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was going to say, James. You took the words right out of my mouth.
I think I forgot to set up the secret behind the scenes money laundering operation to get money to Joe when I left. So we can't pay for exactly the answers we want anymore. Oh. I left in a bit of a hurry. I left a piece of art behind. There's stuff that didn't get done.
It goes to show if you're nice to people you encounter, they want to do more things, especially if it's something that usually is a paycheck as well. Be appreciative of things getting done.
Yes. Absolutely.
Always.
Somebody on the forums at one point, I think, said that, or no, somewhere, said something like, oh, now that Joe's working from home, he has all this extra time to do the Q and Arena. So, and I was like, that's where I kind of have to just like sit on my hands and smile and nod and then go back to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's not like you had a 2-hour commute that you're cutting out. I mean, you're not Michael Sayer, for goodness sakes.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
So we also wanted to talk to you about Packed Worlds, Near Space. Well, might talk to you about Packed Worlds, but what we wanted to talk to you about was Near Space.
Mm-hmm.
I always say Packed Worlds.
I told you before this that Packed Worlds was off limits, that I would not talk about Packed Worlds.
Okay, all right, all right. So
we'll take
Packed Worlds off the table. We will restrict ourselves to Near Space, Mr. Piscini. We apologize for the faux pas. So you were the lead developer for Near Space. What
development
was that
lead, Owen?
Development lead. Wow. What was that process like for you?
Oh, it was fun. As with many books, it was a sort of all hands on deck situation where everybody was, if we're on a starship, changing roles rapidly and jumping to put out fires and start new ones and then put those out too.
I'm
looking at the credits right now because these are some interesting credits. In my view, in that, yeah, I'm listed as development lead, but under development, you have basically the entire Starfinder team, including one Owen Casey Stevens, who was not at Paizo anymore when doing development for this book.
Mm.
I was there for a bit.
A little bit,
I did
yes.
all of the racial alternate traits I was developing before I left.
That's true. And then you took some with you.
And then I took some with me.
Yeah. and we had a bunch of people on the team jump in and help out, including right John, Amanda, Jason, Rob, and then we also list additional development is basically everyone else who worked on the, who didn't work directly in the book but was there answering those questions, you know, at the 11th hour, like what have we said about Vesk, the size of Vesk eggs, and then everyone chips in. And then we had editing lead Adrian Ng also, which was really awesome, and he's no longer at the company, but was a great influence on this book. And then the final person I wanted to call out was the cartographer, Damian Mammoliti, who won an award for his Packed Worlds maps.
He did.
It's awesome. The only reason I'll bring up Packed Worlds. And he did the maps for this book as well, which is really exciting.
That's so cool.
But the process, yeah, was outlining the sucker. Rob did a lot of the outlining of the Vescarium, which is kind of his baby. And I did the outlining for the sort of rules elements, which, you know, kind of tracks. And then we had a lot of great writers, some of whom are here right now. yep, looking around. and I just worked with them, and we got this book done, and it was great. That's what developing is like. It's great all the time. There's never any problems. Everything, all the words fit magically around the pictures, and it all works out the way you know.
I always feel like you can tell if a book was more complicated than it was planned when the same person is listed as a development lead and an author and an editor.
You find an editor on this. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
Joe, you are one of the editors on this, as well as being an author, as well as being the development lead.
I forget exactly what this ran up against, but it might have been a dearth of editors But I did take some pages home to edit also in addition to developing. And so yeah.
On that strip of credits, your name is in there 1, 2, 3, 4 times. So
yikes.
So if anything's wrong with this book, there's a decent percentage chance it's your fault.
It's true. Yeah.
So what's your favorite part of the Near Space book?
What a difficult question that I couldn't possibly have predicted. Let me think for the appropriate human amount of time. I like the art, honestly. There's a lot of art in here that it really makes me happy. Conqueror's Forge going into a giant gas cloud looks really cool. There's some, if you like Skittermanders, there's some really great Skittermander art in here, in my opinion. And the new system map for the Viscarium, I think, is really cool to have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't really pick favorite mechanical elements, although I could per spread probably. There's a lot of stuff in here to like, I think.
Is there anything you've gotten a particularly positive or negative feedback from so far?
Particularly positive or negative. I've heard good things about the Viscarium, just the way we kind of fleshed it out in this book and made it more than just a planets 1 through or prime through 8, you know.
Yeah.
We got to add a whole starship construction station and flesh out high despots and cultures and name drop about 4 billion species. and kind of flesh out some of the relationships that are a little weird when you talk about having a Viscarium that wants to conquer everyone, mm-hmm. but it's also a playable core playable species and
yes.
hanging out everywhere you go.
And an ally of the Pact Worlds, the main political organization that the PCs are likely to find themselves in.
Right, exactly.
So, but they're still a conquering organization. It's interesting.
Yeah, ally and potential future threat.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'll pick? You know, I'm going to pick something different as my favorite thing. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure, totally.
Sure.
I'm going with, I like this Zandite collective. They have a really, so it, part of outlining this book was, okay, we want, so I should say for people who aren't familiar with the structure of this book, there's a chapter on the Viscarium, which is mm-hmm. the whole solar system. Gets a lot of pages per planet, so you can really dive in. Then there's a chapter on the worlds of Near Space, which is 20, I think it's 20 worlds. And they're not just worlds. Some of them are individual planets, but we wanted to do some systems too, some multi-planet systems, so that it's not just the settings, 3 core sort of multi-system empires or whatever. And mm-hmm. so we did the, we picked up the Gitaron Authority, which has been in society play, and the Marixa Republic, which are more or less militant. But part of the outline for me, I really wanted to make sure that we had some societies that had spread to multiple planets, but not through conquering. Like through something else, anything else, basically, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. anything but conquering or colonizing. Can we do that? And yes, we can. Ron Lundin and Mike Kimmel wrote the Helfenthal and Sandai Collective, respectively. And the Sandai Collective, there were all these, like before the gap, even there were all these worlds in I think 7 worlds in like 4 different systems that got these meteorites that just landed on their planets out of nowhere, and they allowed communication among those planets. And this is before they even had interstellar travel of any kind. So they got to talk to each other before trying to kill each other. And so I just like the idea of like, well, we've got nothing else to do but to talk and communicate, cooperate, and develop these technologies together. And then eventually got to meet and try to solve the mystery of like, why even did this happen? Like, where did this come from? So that's my long rant about Sandek.
No, that's super cool, because it asks the question of like, you know, of the vast infinite reaches of space, how did these meteorites manage to strike like what 7 worlds, where not only like 7 planets, like specks of dirt in outer space, but also like that just happened to give rise to intelligent life, which might not be as rare in the Starfinder universe as we suspect it could be in the real world, but it's still rare nevertheless.
Truth.
It would be super boring to write about all the multitude of millions of planets that are just nothing, dirt, nothing, dirt.
Oh, that's actually the next chapter of the book, so.
James, you guessed it.
Is that the chapter that got cut for space is another 30 pages of, there's nothing here.
It's just like a chapter where every page has like 12 columns of just single like word designations for systems and numbers.
No one.
Then there's section C47. It's completely desolate. Let's describe that for the next 27 pages.
Or no, then there's one that's like mostly desolate, but it never tells you what mostly desolate. Mostly desolate.
This planet has exactly 3 colonies. Next.
Which 3?
There was finally something there. Why are you talking about it?
Or no, it says this planet has 3 colonies. See Starfinder Deck of Many Worlds.
There you go. Those are the
that's an interesting point. You are also the designer of the Deck of Many Worlds, Joe. And that's a very popular product. We've had it here on the show and we've shown it to some people, and I've seen some people say some really exciting things about it. If you don't mind talking about it for just a minute, what was the inspiration for you to tackle this very different kind of product?
I love sandbox stuff, and especially in Starfinder, where you have a starship and you can travel across, you can travel faster than light. Why wouldn't you just go anywhere and everywhere possible? Like, that is absolutely what I would do. As a player, or as an in-world character, just, it's exciting to see. And so I wanted a product that would, I'm someone who really believes that limitation breeds create. And so I usually need some kind of like spark to get, which is why development and design is a good fit for me, I think, just because I like taking what other people have started on and then help develop that into a 10 and share it with everybody.
Sure.
So for me, the perfect product would be something that gives you a little bit, prompts questions, and then you answer them, because we're humans, we're weird, we're good at making connections between things that have no right being connected. And so this, mm-hmm. this is just a deck of 100 cards that provides you a bunch of hooks, art of a world that, 100 pieces of art, which is awesome, of different worlds. And then some biomes and physical attributes, and then cultural attributes, like how much technology is there, how much magic, how much religion. And that's completely random with every pairing of cards. Any 2 cards you pick are going to give you a different set of results. And then there's also adventure hooks on each card, and there's also aliens on each card. So you can flesh out a world pretty quickly. And that's actually something that I put into Near Space, sort of in the introduction to exploring Near Space, because there's more than 20 worlds or even systems in Near Space.
Right.
I wanted to communicate that, like, here's a bunch of ideas, and we also even give a bunch of like potential story hooks for people to possibly spin whole campaigns around, or even just, have a planet of the weekend. You're helping some Brenneri mediators go host a secret meeting between Merc's Republic and Gideron Authority, right? To mm-hmm. possibly negotiate peace or something. There's a million ways to use those 20 words. You also want to use, you want to go anywhere and do anything. So
definitely.
Yeah, kind of lost track.
There was also, there's a really interesting interaction between the cards, how you use a static number of cards to randomly generate so much information. Was there any component inspiration for the form factor, anything you'd seen that made you think, I want to do something like that, mm-hmm. so that we can use these cards to create all of these different randomized combinations?
It was, again, going back to sort of limitation, my initial design for the deck was for a 55 card deck, because that's what was slotted into the production schedule, and for various reasons that changed into 110. And so I was mostly just like, how can I get all of this information onto 2 sides of a card, basically? And I play a lot of board games, and there's lots of board games that have you sort of layer cards underneath each other to reveal certain parts or hide. So that was definitely an inspiration. I don't know. I just fiddled with it for a long time and got a lot of help from people at Paizo, which was great.
We have a question for you from chat, from Dungeon Novice. Do Skittermanders have ears?
Oh, that's a good question. There's some art that would imply they do, and some that don't. I think we've gone with that they do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the official answer. Skittermanders definitely have ears.
The official answer is that the lead designer thinks they do. if you look at I think we had to make a call at one point, because I think the cover of Alien Archive, their first appearance, it's not necessarily clear that they have prominent ears, but if you look at, like, in Near Space, we have the bookish Skittermander art.
Might you suggest that different ethnicities of Skittermanders have different size ears?
Yeah, why not? Okay. That's kind of one of the cool things we did in this book, was alternate racial traits and alternate racial, because no species is a monolith, and it's interesting to tease apart, like, what is a physical characteristic of the species, what's cultural, what's just maybe even supernatural, like maybe these species, no matter where they're born, have this weird trait that isn't really explainable by genetics mm-hmm. or culture, but mm-hmm. it's because this is magic space time.
I think my favorite one of those that I saw in this book is the one that says that there are frilled Vesks, and that just makes me think of Vesks that like run around the Veskarium into battle going like, oh, with like big like window thing popping up. I kind of need to see an art of that at some point. So like maybe slip it into a meeting, just, you know, big frilled Vesk with a dashko going in, like it'd be pretty great.
That's thanks awesome. To my Jurassic Park.
I think there's variation. Ratazan's basically a giant iguana. Like
that's true. You know what you could also do? You could have one of those little itty-bitty seed spore guys, the tiny ones, and have one that like goes around with a boombox that just plays the Jurassic theme park song whenever like they're in the Veskarium. So you, da-na-na, and just the Vesk are just walking around doing their normal daily lives.
So, Joe, you were talking about how you liked the idea that there might be, for example, an ethnicity trait that is a magical element. And that, of course, is one of the neat things about Starfinder, that while there are all these science fiction visual trappings, that magic and the gods and mysticism are all a real force. Did you, when you were working on Near Space, was there a time in which you thought, oh, we've gone too sci-fi, we need to think about what the weird magic of Near Space is?
That is something that we kind of tend to do in Starfinder, is go sci-fi heavy. But because we know we do that, we then look back to magic as much as possible. Mm-hmm. We have a whole chapter of spells or a whole section written by, who was it again? Does anybody here remember
mm-hmm.
who
wrote the spells? I think I wrote most or all of the spells that appear in this book.
Yeah.
I think you are right. Having stuff like that, having a lot of the equipment has magical qualities or is hybrid, you know, or mm-hmm. just has stuff right. that doesn't make sense in a sci-fi universe, and that I think that helps us cover our base. So I can't think of a specific time during development of this book that it was like, no, need mostly because we have a lot of these 20 worlds that we dove into are very specifically weird magic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's Neminar, which is, you know, magically dark, basically, because somebody pissed off, somebody angered a god back in the day.
What? Never.
So you're gonna... yeah.
You know, Clash of the Titans.
Hmm.
Unleash the giant mecha titan, or the kaiju, or...
So oh, yeah,
I guess
sure.
the question... I was going to say, I guess the question is, did they piss off Sarenrae, or did they please Zonkuthon?
You'll have to read to find out. It's neither of those.
No!
The answer might surprise you to be neither. It's not any of those.
Now I'm envisioning an entire book arranged just with clickbait titles, right? Top 10 feats you can give your character.
But you won't.
GMs hate.
But you won't qualify. Yeah.
Dungeon Novice points out that right now the Near Space PDF is less than $8. It's $7 and 49 cents.
Oh wow!
To go buy
it. Sale strikes again. Yeah,
it's so good.
Yeah,
just to look fantastic. At the art, it's worth $8.
I almost thought about buying it. It's like, wait, I don't need to do that.
You're like, wow, I'm gonna go run out and
I mean, that's like $1 per Vesk planet, basically.
And this is a good time to point out that this is recorded live in front of a Twitch audience Wednesday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Every week, No Direction Network has some sort of live content at that time and day of the week. So thanks so much. If you want to join the conversation in order to ask Joe or any of our guests questions, definitely jump on the Twitch stream and jump into chat and join us.
Totally. So, I have a question for you, Joe. Are you ready? You ready?
No, hit me.
Oh, no. Oh, I don't want to hit you. Anyway, when you go to the player's option section, I think it's safe to say that the player's option section of Near Space is much more robust than the other campaign setting focused hardcover that we were told we weren't allowed to name. One thing that was really cool to me is that there's tons of alternate racial traits for so many of the Veskarium and Near Space races in this book, but obviously you can't fit all of them. Like, poor Brunieri. They didn't get any alternate racial traits here. I can only assume it's because the Weeze was busy that weekend. But so when you when you're going through and trying to figure out which species to write about in this book, how did you pick and choose?
Well, it's surprising how quickly you run out of space in these books. Maybe not surprising to some people, but for me, I'm always like, oh, we can do everything, all of it. Put it all in. It's like, wait, that's 300 pages, and we don't have the human beings necessary to compile such a thing. So we definitely did pick apart our canon. We even looked at, you know, species that we hadn't said where they were from necessarily, and like, mm-hmm. can we make them near space? And I think we did that in a few cases at least. But when it came to which of these species to do, I don't remember why Brunieri didn't make the cut. You would think.
I was just curious. Oh, go ahead.
No, yeah.
I was going to say, I was just curious because I built an envoy Brunieri, and like I used the really cool battle leader, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And that archetype's awesome. I got to use its abilities in Signal of Screams, and everyone was like, wait, you give me damage? I was like, yes. and the art for that is a Brunieri. I was like, oh, this is great. That's right. They are a near space race. I was like, oh, there's no options in here for them. I was like, oh, well, good thing their core kit is pretty okay. So that's fine.
I almost want to say that it's but no, that doesn't work either. I was going to say maybe it's an A2 versus AA3 thing. Where is Chikri A Alien Archive 2? Who remembers? Who's going to win the
Chikri? are they the shrimp people, or are they the which one?
Chikris are the squid ones.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, they're Alien Archives 3, but I assumed that they had to be in the book because they're specifically Vesk 2.
Like, yeah.
I actually published my article for No Direction today is about how crucial that entry in Alien Archive 3 is to the Starfinder campaign setting. So, like, to me, that made perfect sense why they would be in this book.
Yeah.
Dedicated a chapter.
We just ran out of room. Yeah. So we got.
That happens.
Well, and Brunieri are already so adorable. I don't know that they need anything else.
I think Brunieri would argue against that.
I made sure to include. Well, and that battle leader Brunieri you talk about does have a wicked scar, you know, to show up.
So it's such a good art. It was to the point where I needed a roll 20 token, and like up until that point I was using the otter leader from South Park, the one who like takes the clams and bashes them on his tummy, and then I saw that I was like, no, this is better, we're gonna take this, sorry joke, we're gonna go with legit art.
I gotta say, I mean, it's an angry little guy with a scar on his face, but at its core that is still an adorable fluffy little otter guy, right? It's the more fierce he gets, the more you sort of just go, oh look, he's got a mad.
What page is that?
144.
No, it's that for those of us
that
on
page has my other favorite thing of this book.
What is your other favorite thing, Joe?
It's the Gotham ability, alternate class.
That's the one I took.
Yeah, that's basically. I think that was pitched for this book, like in the outline stage. So it's like, okay, what are we doing with archetypes? We have to. Get him is such a thing in Starfinder. Mm-hmm. I want to got him.
I got him.
Yeah, you did it. I want you now to be you able just to need get him. Got him.
You just need a third ability called good, and then
yep. Which has both get him and got him as prerequisites. So you got to get him, got him to be good.
Absolutely. So
I think good is the regroup ability where you give your party stamina back after downing an enemy. Get him, got him.
I have all of these abilities you guys are talking about. It's great. It's like you're in my head.
That's another favorite thing about this book is some of these archetypes you can, so including this one, the battle leader, which we're talking about, there's, so you get your second level alternate class feature that replaces whatever your second level class feature was, but then at 4th, 6th, 9th, and 18th, you decide whether you want to take the archetype's ability, which is another battle cry.
So good.
Or you can just keep what your class gives you. And I think that flexibility is really just adds a lot of fun and depth. I worry sometimes that taking an archetype means you give up too much of your character sometimes, which is, and we've done that, we've handled that in multiple ways. One is just having fewer replacement features. So maybe it's only second and fourth that you replace something from your archetype.
Yeah.
But I really liked giving people the options.
On one hand, it's like, as a designer though, on one hand, it's really nice to be able to say, hey, you can pick and choose which of these you want to swap out and which of these you don't. But on the other hand, you need to be really careful, right? Because you don't want it to be too much like, well, this is sort of a weak option, so everyone skips it, because that's no good. You know, you have to make everything seem like, this is really good. So
it's very tricky.
It's a tough balance.
Angle of the character.
one of the things we did with the character operations manual was to have archetypes that had a lot of different ways that we were trying to answer that question, so that we could show people the powers don't have to be, you only get this one thing. We can make it variable. We can decide what levels you get them at. I think it's also the character operations manual where you're like, what if you only get this archetype at super high level, because part of the concept is you're super competent. So it just doesn't make sense at second level. Because I think our instructor does that.
That's cool.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Okay.
So right. Joe, that's near space. So Joe, there's a lot of fantastic stuff in this book. Is there anything that you wish you could have put in the book, but you couldn't because of room or other constraints?
That you're willing to talk about?
Yes.
I mean, now I want Brunneri alternate racial ties in here.
Listen, just ask Louise. He's got you.
They were on the short list, just not the shortest list, the one that made it in. No, honestly, you know, yeah.
Oh, good.
Just more near space worlds. I'm always about adding more. If we could have just had more page count and added yet more weird and wild worlds for people to go to and for me to order art for, that would have been a lot of fun, I think. Mm-hmm.
Some of that's the best stuff for home GMs, because if they're not running an AP, let's say, there's so many great adventure hooks in there, especially you name drop an organization or one little thing, and then they can hook in and be like, oh, wait, I can do something with this. And that more that you flesh out those systems and those worlds, the more those GMs have to work for, and the more the world becomes real to the players. Even if they're never visiting there, you just go, I know that there are blood sports in this one colony because it says so, and now it's part of my world. And I can be like, what are you doing? I'm just watching the latest match from this other colony, and it's canon. It's fantastic.
Yeah, we do it for ourselves too. We name drop as much as we can, and kind of see what people glom onto too, but also what strikes our imagination, because you know, we have a lot of books to make and we always need more ideas. So
if it was your call, and I'm aware it's not, so we're not asking you to reveal what the schedule is, but if it was your call, would you rather do a second near space book or a vast book first?
I think it would make sense to do a vast book first, just because we have done a Pact Worlds book and a Near Space book.
You just feel that's logical?
Yeah, I think it'd be kind of confusing if we didn't do that at some point. I could, and I'm interested in sort of exploring the differences between Near Space and Vast, right? Because we, even on the team, we've talked about that. Like, what is the difference? You know, you're sitting in your ship for some number of days and then you pop out somewhere. Like, is there an actual, and yeah, I think there are some differences. It feels wilder, more dangerous. Just getting there, your chance for a drift encounter goes up, right? Mm-hmm. Just per the mechanics. Yeah.
I think there's, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think there's, that's it. I was just going to repeat myself, so please.
I was going to say that if you do decide to go back to Near Space, Dungeon Novice recommends less Near Space as the title of that book.
I'd say fewer.
Close space.
Fewer near space.
Moderate distance space.
Near space, but not quite as near as last time.
Oh, social distance space. There we go.
Too soon. Well, and one of the interesting things about the Vast is that both Near Space and the Pact Worlds have core races that are from there, right? And none of our core races are native to the Vast. So it doesn't have that I can be from there easily feel to it. It's automatically this further, less well understood space, which I don't mean space, I mean area. But
yes.
Did you do the art order for the double trucks for the Vescarium?
I believe so. Yeah, I did the art order for this whole book, I think.
Okay. So I found it really interesting looking at it that Vesk Prime has like this giant pyramid in the double truck. And then you go down to Vesk 2, and it has this very Greek temple. And you go on to Vesk 3, and it has a more Polynesian almost feel. Were those conscious choices to try and indicate different cultural notes of each world?
Depends. Do you think it worked?
I want your answer first, Mr. Pacini.
Not necessarily. I mean, certainly with each art brief that I passed on to the art team, and they, you know, fixed and sent to our artists who fixed it some more and saved us from ourselves. They captured what I think was most interesting about each of those places. And I think, you know, Vesk 3 is where Skindermanders are from. And so I want to see how Skindermanders live, you know, in sort of independent, not, I don't want to see the command, just the gosh,
You don't want to see the colonized Vesk City on Vesk 3. You want to see Skittermander City.
I don't want to see the Command same.
Command 2, like, right?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Skittermanders?
Oh, no, I was just... Never mind. Go ahead.
No, that's definitely a thing. But yeah, the different commands with just a changing backdrop, like it was a Zoom meeting, that's not all that compelling to me. But like, so the Greek-looking temples on Vesk 2, those are the ones that... Those are the mysterious ruins with weird giant tentacles next to them. Mm-hmm. That is one of the interesting things about that place a little bit. And the text gets into the Vesk presence and what it's like. And I think it varies pretty nicely. I was pleasantly surprised with the way that came out. This was something that Rob wrote the Vesk, Rob McCreary, the creative director, wrote Vesk Prime's entry. And then he developed sort of the rest of the Vesk entries for the book. So he gets to sort of unify everything for his vision of what the Vescarium is. And I think that's makes it super consistent, but also with the variety of authors we had, everyone got to sort of insert their own fun little stuff in here. Mm-hmm. Like Diego Valdez wrote Vesk 7 and 8, the sort of cold worlds with the Kothama, the peaceful looking folks who are in Alien Archive 3, which Diego also wrote their entry. So there's sort of shared moon stuff going on.
So speaking of cute little things, I noticed that on the Vesk 3 write-up, we're told the Skittermanders still call their world, and I'm going to try and pronounce this, Odert Chonk.
That's so close. You know... Try one more time.
What? What's your take on that pronunciation, Joe?
I think that was wonderful. And
okay,
for your home game, I think that's perfectly appropriate.
I think Odor Chunk is fine for a home game. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to make a society ruling on how that's pronounced here on this screen.
Was that covered in the outline, or did the writer decide what they thought Skittermanders would call Vesk 3?
Well, I'll tell you, the writer was Crystal Frazier, and leave it at that.
That's,
of course, it had to be.
Of course it did. Yeah. For those that don't know, Crystal gave us the Skittermanders, so you kind of have to let her give us the Skittermander homeworld.
Absolutely.
Which I am 100% on board with believing that Crystal came up with Odor Chunk. That sounds like Crystal.
We also asked her to write the Skittermander Eater. The Stridermander.
Yeah. I still want to do undead Skittermanders called Staggermanders, but I haven't had a chance yet.
No, you might keep an eye out on upcoming products.
Ooh.
Now I'm afraid.
They're here to help you to death.
I like
them. Well, they're evil. They're here to help themselves to your brains.
So what you did most of the development of this book, was it about 50-50 before you were the lead designer?
Oh, that's a great question. You'd have to tell me when you left, and I'd have to look at some some calendars.
I left in June.
I mean, it must have. Yeah, it must have been.
I mean, I know you were working on it before I left. I just didn't know what percentage of it. Have you found the whole? If people don't know, there's a long cycle to making these. There's pitching a product. There's outlining a project. There's assigning it. There's getting it in. There's developing it. There's doing layout changes. Have you found those steps are different for you as the lead designer than they were as a developer?
Not significantly, I would say. I tend to poke my nose into other development cycles more. Uh-huh. With the permission of my wonderful colleagues, of course. I'm like, hey, if you have any rules content, send it my way. And I also fortunately have them offering to do the same thing, which is looking at rules content that we write. I'm also more hyper aware of things that we have to write in-house for whatever reason. That I treat those as basically drafts, and I want as many eyes on it as possible, playtesting if needed, if it's, you know, a subsystem or something major like that. Because it feels like it has my name on it, even though it can't possibly, because there is so much that we put out.
Sure.
For a relatively small team. But in terms of the process of outlining, it probably makes me a more wordy outliner in that I go into a lot more detail than I might need to. I remember Adam Daigle at one point, when I was learning the developer trade, looked over at me while I was typing away on this, it's like a 7,000 word outline for something. He's like, hey, you know, if the outline's longer than the assignment, you're doing something wrong. Yeah, that makes sense. So it's striking a balance between, being too specific, and because you also want to give people the freedom to make cool stuff. You
know? Oh, absolutely.
Like all of it, but the details, you're, you know, not trying to make Mad Libs, like fill in some nouns and give this back to me. Yeah. You want people.
Yeah, absolutely. There needs to be that opening for creative freedom to take a look and say, you know, they mentioned that there needs to be a predator here. What kind of predator would be here? And then get their wheels, you know, creative wheels turning instead of saying a predator such as here's three alien archive creatures. And you're like, oh, I guess I'm using one of those three. It's like, no, just keep it open. It's fine.
Totally.
So,
horrific. Go ahead.
Ogrex one said, I hope we get more Starfinder lore books. I was pretty impressed with this book. So, that's some feedback, and be aware there are people out there that want more books with more lore.
Mm-hmm. And earlier, Dungeon Nova said, as someone who doesn't play Starfinder but enjoys the setting, Near Space is a definite get for me. So
awesome.
Sounds like a...
Just one thing I wanted to touch on, actually, is sort of this idea that I think we inherited from Pathfinder, a distinction between setting, like where there are set and then rules books. And that's something Starfinder has kind of bucked from its... inception, right? Like with even Alien Archives just having a bunch of player options tucked into them. And that's something I'm really interested in continuing with Starfinder is trying to think of these more as like, here's a bunch of setting information with sensible mechanical stuff that you can use in your game, all of which you can reflavor if you need to or want to, or rename or just not name. You know, for instance, we have in this book, there's a shield, like a gravity shield. And the flavor of it is that it's using this sort of gravity influencing coral from the Capexi's homeworld. But you don't need any of that if you don't want it. If it doesn't add to your game, you can just have a cool shield that grabs people's weapons out of their hands. And I think that's a big plus for this. Obviously this is a lore book. Like you can't say that this is not a setting book, a giant chapter on a solar system that is purely flavor, but hopefully what I'm saying is making sense to someone else besides, which is that,
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's an effort to have everything that makes sense from a given region, regardless of what that makes sense is, right? Mm-hmm. If we have gravity influential coral, then someone's going to do something with it. So here's a gravity shield using that coral. That just makes sense. And it means that you're not hopping one place to learn what a place is like and another place for all the rules associated with it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And they don't have two different books based on the player side and GM side for the same ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And I like that. Well, I don't know if that's universal, but.
Well, you know, Joe, I think if you can manage it, the entire universe would like more Starfinder.
Hey, me too.
Specifically, Ogrex1 in chat mentioned that they would like a deck of many worlds sort of product, but doing something similar with an NPC deck that makes unique NPCs.
Yeah, that's you know, buy out the deck of many worlds, prove the concept to Paizo, and then maybe I'll get to do more.
Deck of many faces.
So that's like a quarter of a face on each card, and you mash them together into a horrid.
Oh god!
No, I think
one, the front of one card is eyes, and the other cards have chins and eyebrows. And
okay, this is horror show now. Please don't do that.
Is this how we got that terrifying Skittermander conglomeration monster?
No, that was a drift accident.
Yeah.
No, I think that would be actually pretty cool. Just a product that was like, all right, so here's, you know, the species, essentially. Here's their class or job. Here's some traits about them, personality traits. And here's some motivations. And it's like, oh, okay. You can just sort of come up with one on the fly. That'd be pretty cool.
I agree. I think that'd be really cool. And I think Joe would do a really good job designing it.
Mm-hmm. It was something I tried to incorporate into the deck of many worlds a bit. And there's a one side of a rules card that tells you how to build NPCs with the deck. Because there are a bunch of species. There's like 100 playable species and then some others. And then there are traits too that you can kind of massage into a class and sort of a hook. But yeah, I would love to do a whole series of these decks. I think it'd be awesome.
Definitely.
So we're looking like we've used most of our time. Joe, do you have any other thoughts you want to share with people before we see if anyone has final questions we want to shoot at you?
I'll think about that if while we're looking at final.
So anyone on our panel or anyone on Twitch have final things that they want to run by Joe for their, to make sure that we maximize his time since we don't get him on here often enough?
Will you come back again soon?
Yeah, there's something I'm kind of dying to for it to be announced so that I can talk about it as much as possible.
Well, the second it's announced, you let us know that you're ready to talk about it, and we'll get you on.
We would love to have you on after whatever the thing that has you excited is announced.
Sounds good.
James, what was your
question about? Was not a question, but just a thing of note is there's an assassin archetype in this book, and I didn't think we'd see something like that, considering like there's no coup de grace rules, and that's a I don't know. It seems like a lot of Starfinder stuff has gone to be more like open and away from that really dark side of role playing, kind of letting people figure that out themselves. Just seeing that in the book is it's cool to see more stuff being integrated as far as like tone.
Yeah, I was very careful with that one because it can go real dark real fast. And I think of Starfinder as a game of you know, heroes on a starship for the most part. But of course, we support many modes of play, he said carefully.
Well, it's nice because
there's like two saves against it, and there's even stuff in the description like, hey, not all these people are evil. Sometimes you need to do this for good things.
Yep.
Please don't murder for evil only.
There's a child in a gorilla pit and you just have to do it, you know?
Oh no, why would you make that joke?
No, moving on.
So one more question from chat. Ograx1 asks, is Starfinder going to see this release schedule maintained with more releases, essentially saying having one book wasn't enough? Are we going to pick up the pace, or what does the release schedule look like?
Basically just what we've announced. Okay. I wouldn't expect any major changes to the release schedule unless we see major changes to the team size.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah, we basically have hit our stride on what we can produce.
Do you feel like you've got a good handle as a team on how much you can actually produce with the people you've got in the situation you're in?
Yeah, which is, especially these work from home days, it's been an interesting transition, but company-wide, it's been really impressive to see everybody pull together and keep making cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Cool. Does anyone have anyone, Joe included, does anyone have anything they want to promote before we do our sign-offs and such?
Deck of Many Worlds.
Seriously, the Deck of Many Worlds is a awesome thing, and I really think that people ought to go pick it up, especially if you find the utility. Even if the Deck of Many Worlds is a cusp purchase for you, and you're like, I'd really rather have an NPC deck or a magic item deck or an adventure hook deck just for an adventurers, buy this one. Convince Paizo to give Joe the time to design more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, do it. Buy all the decks of many worlds.
Buy all the decks of many worlds. The 100 card deck that was always supposed to be that side. Okay. Well, Vanessa, is the current plan for us to be back in 2 weeks? Yes?
The original release date was, another 2 weeks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, then on behalf of the whole No Direction team, I appreciate you being with us, Joe. And on behalf of James and Vanessa and Alex, I'm Owen Casey Stevens. And thank you all for joining us, folks. And please, until we're back in 2 weeks, go beyond with No Direction Beyond.